On the morning of April 28, 1789, Master's Mate Fletcher Christian led a mutiny against Lieutenant, better known to us as Captain William Bligh, placing Bligh and 18 officers and crew in a small boat and setting them adrift. The tale of the mutiny on the Bounty has been told many times in prose, poetry, and film. Three major films, to be exact. So what more is there to say? A great deal, it seems, and the story as told by our guest this week, Caroline Alexander, is a far different story from that which most of us know. Caroline Alexander is the author of The Bounty, the true story of the mutiny on the Bounty, published by Viking Press. She's also the author of four previous books, most recently The Endurance, Shackleton's legendary Antarctic expedition. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. What led you to investigate the history behind the mutiny on the Bounty?
Shackleton, the subject of my previous book, was what led me indirectly to the Bounty. People who know that story will know that at the heart of Shackleton's great journey of survival is an amazing open boat voyage. And in trying to put his voyage into some sort of historical perspective, I did reading of other voyages and found that the only one ever spoken of in the same sort of reverential breath was the voyage of William Bligh in the Bounty's launch after the mutiny on the Bounty. So that was the hook for me.
What was the date of the Shackleton, or approximately when did that occur?
Shackleton's expedition set out in 1914, and then he sort of stumbled back finally in 1916. And so Bligh's voyage predated his by about 120-something years.
Right. Okay. Any other modern historical accounts of the voyage, the Bounty I'm talking about now?
Not historical in its entirety, no, not at all. There's some very fine, two, I think, very good biographies of William Bligh published some decades ago, which are very sober, careful examinations of his life from beginning to end. And those biographers clearly had a handle on the entirety of who Bligh was and had him in perspective, as it were, and are very clear that they regard him as an honorable man and not a villain. But to find a coherent sort of complete story of the mutiny on the Bounty in print, really, you almost have to go back to John Barrow's account, which was published in 1831 and is still sort of available in folio editions and so forth. There have been others. There was a biography about Fletcher Christian by a Christian family descendant, which has wonderful new material about Christian, but is, I think, otherwise very, we'll say, unduly pro-Christian. But this complete story, believe it or not, in a kind of authoritative historical examination of this legend really didn't exist. That the classic that everybody would, you know, reach to put their hand to was a work were the works of fiction by Nordhoff and Hall, the famous trilogy of the Mutiny on the Bounty.
Okay, and you more or less start off from the perspective that the story told there in that classic, if you will, is all wrong.
Well, I didn't start off with it. What I did start off with was an interest, and again, I'm going to sort of revert to Shackleton for a moment. What fascinated me about that voyage was obviously the personality of Sir Ernest Shackleton, but I was also, I think, equally interested in the men he led. And that led me to do quite extensive investigation into finding out different family members, and I got new material that way. And I sort of brought the same kind of approach to the Bounty, which was that there were more than two men on the Bounty. It wasn't just William Bligh and Fletcher Christian. And I think that that approach, this sort of power of darkness and the Prince Galahad figure of Fletcher Christian, has not just sort of, well, it's made a fabulous story, let's be very honest. Mm-hmm. It's a great romantic tale. But I think it has somewhat warped actual research, not just presentation, but I felt even the way people approach the material. For example, to look at Bligh's log, which is a wonderful source material, not just as a key to clues where Fletcher Christian's name might crop up or signs of imminent trouble, but to just take it as you would any other log of another voyage and just look at it and see the journey unfolding, and also very, very revealing of Bligh's own character as a man, not just as the person who's going to be mutinied about. And so I felt that there was a way that if one was prepared to look at this as a totality, as a fresh story, as an event without bouncing off anybody else's approach, one was going to be able to make fresher use of old material.
Okay. Tell us the story. Refresh our memory. What happened that morning of April 28th, 1789?
Well, Bligh is commander of the Bounty. He's Lieutenant Bligh, given the honorary title, as it were, for the purpose of this ship of captain of the Bounty, which is now somewhere in the wide Pacific. They're about 3 weeks out from Tahiti on the homeward voyage, having successfully accomplished this task of getting, a centric task of getting breadfruit plants, which Bligh's now going to try and take over to the West Indies. Critical to the story is the fact that the next important landmark on this voyage was going to be the navigation of what was then called the Endeavour Strait. This is now the Torres Strait, the very dangerous divide between Northern Australia and New Guinea. This is where the only British naval ship to have attempted this was Captain Cook, who ran aground on the Great Barrier Reef. It is today notoriously difficult to navigate, even with Torres Strait pilots and beacons and everything else. And one thing that's generally not regarded about this voyage is that I think the Admiralty were very indifferent to the breadfruit venture, which they'd sort of been shanghaied into doing by merchant interest, but they were interested in the navigation of the Endeavour Strait. And transcripts that come up from what various mutineers said in their court-martial and other men who were later interviewed indicate that everybody was braced to have to work very hard in going through the Endeavour Strait. And Christian was reported to have said, in approaching the Endeavour Strait, I'm sure the ship will be a hell. So that's on his mind when he goes into the cabin and yanks Bligh out of sleep, brings him up on board and says, you are no longer in command of this ship.
Okay. And they cast off Bligh and some of the crew in a small boat. And what happens to Bligh?
In a very small boat. And more men than they had planned join Bligh. So at the end of the day, you have a small boat, 23 feet long, with 19 men in it, and consigned to certain death. And Bligh seems to have lost no time in deciding that he was going to get back to England. And this is, again, remarkably documented in his log. So with food that should have lasted them about 5 days, they embarked on what would be a 48-day ordeal with no charts and very crude navigation equipment. And Bligh brought his company, his men, save one who was murdered by islanders on one island landfall, to the safety in the Dutch East Indies.
So he was good at what he did.
He was very good at what he did, and this is why this voyage is regarded with such veneration by sort of sailors.
Sure. What about the mutinous crew? What happened to them?
Well, they sort of fared well for a while, but then they also came unstuck. Their intention was to head to Tahiti, and then somewhere I think they suddenly realized that that might not be the wisest thing to do, given that that was one of the few islands in the Pacific that the British Navy knew about and could be counted on to finally return to look for them. So they tried to make a settlement on the island of Tubuai. That didn't work. They were at each other's throat. Christian starts becoming, in a way, quite despotic, according to some reports, always carrying a pistol with him and threatening to flog men when they didn't comply with his orders. This all comes from a manuscript source from one of the men later charged with mutiny. And then finally they decide, okay, we can't hang together as a group. So some return to Tahiti to wait their fate, and 8 men go with Christian and the Bounty off to roam the seas looking for an uninhabited island, which they found in a remote island called Pitcairn, where they finally sort of decided to make a home, came on shore, and then burnt the Bounty and therefore burnt their bridges.
Does everyone get back home eventually?
Very few get back. Well, bits and pieces get back home. Bligh gets back home, makes a report to the Admiralty. The Admiralty comes out to make sure that as many mutineers as they can bring back home do come home. And indeed, 10 mutineers eventually are captured and brought, arrive in chains in Britain, and they are the ones who stand court-martial for Christian's crime, as it were. And then the big mystery is what happens to Fletcher Christian. And there are various reports, a number of reports that he died on Pitcairn Island, although he always seems to die in a different way, which is suspect. And then there are many sort of Elvis sightings of Christian in England. So whether he got home or not is I guess, an enigma.
Okay. Tell us about the trial.
Well, the trial is, to me, where the dynamics of the story really, the story we know as the Mutiny on the Bounty is created. You have a situation where 10 men are now facing death if they're found guilty of mutiny. One of these men, the only officer, a young midshipman called Peter Heywood, happens to be connected to, as I discovered, Lord Howe, who was the highest naval figure in the land. So to save him, his various family connections rally around, and the result is, at the end of the day, that 4 men are exonerated on Bligh's word as being held against their will by the mutineers. 3 men are hanged, but Peter Heywood and his companions are pardoned and therefore set free. And it's the dynamics of the court-martial and the special interest pulled there and the way the story is manipulated that most interested me, and I think I found the most new material on.
So the story comes out quite differently from the court-martial than you understand it historically.
Yes. What you see going into the court-martial is a straightforward account of Bligh as the sort of hero of his own little saga, an officer doing his job who was overpowered by pirates and who somehow heroically managed to get back to England to make a report to king and country. That's the story going into the trial. Coming out of the trial, once Peter Heywood, this young officer, is safe and knows he's not going to hang, you start seeing the story being recreated, both by his family and by Fletcher Christian's family. And what they decided to do, clearly, and I think may have almost been acting on instinct, almost believing it, is to declare, which had never been suggested before in British naval history, that there was a justification for mutiny, a reason for it. And the reason was tyranny and oppression. And this, of course, is all being spun out at the height of the French Revolution. A lot of revolutionary sympathizers are still in England, and many of them, in fact, were friends of the Christians. It's also the beginning of the Romantic movement in literature. I think Fletcher Christian's cause was greatly helped by the fact that his school friend and schoolfellow was William Wordsworth, and the Wordsworth and the Christians were very, very close. And what you have is suddenly a romantic hero. I think Fletcher Christian was the first romantic hero, a romantic hero who spurns oppression and tyranny and somehow has declared himself for the rights of man, as it were, and sailed off into the South Seas, sort of wandering like the ancient mariner across the ocean looking for a place to expiate his rather glamorous sin. So that is the story that has really come down to us, and it depended upon motivating the mutiny in a way that I think it was almost motiveless, and that meant making Bligh the villain.
Interesting. So the story resonates. It's really fit well into the context of the times. What if the story had not been changed? What if it had come down pretty much as happened? Would the story have just died in terms of its popularity at the time?
I think so. I think it would have been a footnote in history, and I think we would have learnt about it. I don't think it would have vanished, because I think Bligh's open boat voyage would have secured its historical place, and at least people interested in the sea would sort of come back to that. But my guess is that if the spin hadn't happened, the story would have ended with the triumphant return of William Bligh. In other words, there would have been a mutiny at sea, and the heroic captain would have brought his men home, and that would be the climax, the return of Bligh to the Admiralty.
Interesting. Where'd you get your information for this?
In many places. Some of it was well-trodden material that just needed to be sort of re-looked at, but much was fresh. I found a great deal on the Isle of Man that related to Peter Heywood and his family background that was highly illuminating. Letters from Lord Howe that were found at the Huntington Library, which had never been seen in this in the context of this story. And then I was had a lot of luck with wills. Wills tell you a great deal about who really counts in a person's life, in terms of who they name as executor or legatee. And that revealed to me some very, very interesting and totally unexpected connections between some of the players.
Well, I like the romanticized version, but that really set up your book perfectly to be able to challenge that, and you did a good job with it. You got another book in the works?
I haven't quite emerged from the 18th century yet, so I need to decompress first.
Okay, great. Well, good luck and congratulations on your new book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good.
Our guest this week has been Caroline Alexander, author of The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty, published by Viking Press. And this is Talking History.